Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. We're really thrilled to have with us Alyssa Ayers, the author of the new book, Our Time Has Come, How India is Finding Its Place in the World. Alyssa is here in Australia as part of a conference with some of our colleagues in Perth, but offered to drop by Sydney, and we're happy to be able to do an India event for the first time in a while. Alyssa, this title, Our Time Has Come, it's an interesting title. It's a quote from two prime ministers of India, Narendra Modi and Manmohan Singh. But there's a little bit of a debate in India as to what exactly this means, our time has come. Could you tell us a little bit more about that debate and what these two prime ministers see that as meaning for India's place in the world?
I think there's definitely a consensus that at some level, India is making its way to a place of global power in a way that wasn't the case 10 years ago. You've seen tremendous economic growth in India. For the last 3 years, India has been the world's seventh largest economy. Estimates suggest that this year, by the end of 2018, the end of this calendar year, India could overtake the economies of the UK and France, becomes the world's fifth largest economy, which really starts to put India in a little bit different place than it's been. It's sort of one thing to be among the world's top 10, to be the seventh largest economy, to have a larger economy than, let's say, Canada and Italy and Brazil. It is a little bit different to be in the world's top five. So there's definitely a sense that there's been this great growth and dynamism, and why doesn't the world yet recognize where India has arrived? That's an economic piece. You see India also doing much more in terms of its diplomacy, the way India is looking to reach out and do more around the world with different partners. It's doing much more, especially in the maritime space, in the Indian Ocean. The space where India continues to be very challenged is in the space of global governance, where it does not have a seat in many of the institutions of global governance that were created in the 20th century, and it would very much like to be there.
There's a sort of the Stan Lee, the comic book author, famously said that, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And you talk a little bit in the book about how Indians feel about some of the expectations that have been heaped upon them by the outside world. As they become richer, what their responsibilities should be with regard to global issues and how they've responded to crises when they have been given a seat at the table in the UN Security Council, for instance, during the Libya and Syria crises five, six years ago. What is that debate like within India about those responsibilities? Do Indians relish those responsibilities? Are they looking forward to them? Or are they worried about what it means for India's place in the world and ability to develop?
So that's a couple different questions put together, one of which is about India's view of how it should, what type of role it should be playing in the UN and in the UN Human Rights Council. Another aspect of that question is actually what India is delivering in terms of humanitarian assistance in the region. So let me actually take that second piece, because I think that's where you've seen a great deal of change. In 2015, when Yemen collapsed, the government of Yemen collapsed, the United States had already evacuated its personnel from our embassy there. It was actually the Indian government that rescued more than 1,000 foreign citizens from more than 40 countries. That was a kind of new moment where India was providing this sort of global public good of relief and assistance, not only to its own citizens, but to citizens from many other countries. You increasingly are seeing India playing that role across the Indian Ocean region, and you hear India referring to itself as interested in playing the role of being a net provider of regional security. As I talk about in the book, that's something that you see reflected in the way that U.S. defense planners, U.S. secretaries of defense now talk about India as a net provider of regional security. It was the first on the ground after the Nepal earthquake. It provides, you know, was one of the first coordinated with the United States, with Australia, with Japan after the tsunami in December 2004. So you see those types of examples. The question about whether to take a position publicly or vote on a single country resolution in the Human Rights Council or within the UN is a little bit different. And there, the answer is often abstain.
And India is a world leader in abstentions at the UN Human Rights Council and at the Security Council. But what's behind that? Why is India reluctant to take a position on these single country human rights issues or sort of global issues like Syria and Libya?
Yeah, it's a philosophical position. It's not necessarily a position of saying It is not the Indian government saying we think that there should be no response on these problems of crises in a specific country. It's rather that in general, the Indian position on a single country resolution is that these are unhelpful mechanisms to bring about change in a third country, and that rather private diplomacy should be the way to bring about change in whatever, a human rights situation in a country, a domestic problem, a crisis. The Indian Ministry of External Affairs has issued formal statements actually explaining that they believe philosophically it's actually back-channel private diplomacy that's more helpful. There's a big caveat to everything I just said, and that's if there's a problem nearby in a neighboring country. So,
and that seems to be the only situation in which India will send troops overseas without a UN flag. Is that still the case, or should we expect to see India participating in India's armed forces participating in regional affairs more broadly as India becomes richer and takes that place at the table?
For now, we see an Indian position that's very focused on the UN flag as the means through which it would participate in any kind of peacekeeping situation. It's very active in UN peacekeeping among the world's top troop contributors on an annual basis, and in a historical sense, cumulatively, the world's top peacekeeping troop contributor. India typically does not send troops to its near neighborhood. It has done that on a couple of occasions with not great results. Sending troops to Sri Lanka, in fact, was still a bruise on Indian foreign policy. There's a big debate right now in India about what to do about this crisis in the Maldives. If anybody's been following the crisis in the Maldives with a situation and state of emergency that's just been extended. In general, New Delhi is willing to speak out about problems in the neighborhood, but not necessarily ready to send troops.
And how does it perceive China's role in its neighborhood? There's this long partnership with Pakistan, but it seems that in recent years, Indian diplomats and leaders have become more concerned about China's role in the region. Is that fair to say? And how are they reacting to the role that China's playing in its near abroad?
More than fair to say. That's fair to say would be an understatement. I think there's a lot of concern now in New Delhi about the type of influence that China is looking to exert across the entirety of the Indian Ocean region. So, let's say 10 years ago, there was some concern about whether China was looking to develop a sort of string of pearls strategy. Some of you may have heard that term before, creating very strong economic relationships with smaller countries through investments in infrastructure development. We've seen that theory of engagement actually blossom into the Belt and Road strategy, actually, around the world. But in many ways, the South Asian countries in the South Asia region were kind of early examples of what the Belt and Road has become. Investments in Sri Lanka are, you know, sort of the paradigmatic case here. India's been very concerned about what this has meant. Will there be facilities that are developed, let's say ports, that end up becoming bases for Chinese military? There's now a Chinese military base in Djibouti. The Indian government has long worried about what might happen with Sri Lanka, and we now see that indebtedness to fund these projects has resulted in allocating equity positions for Chinese state-owned enterprises to run operations for things like the Hambantota port. So that's been a real concern. The China relationship with Pakistan is of another order. They've had a very deep relationship for decades, a very deep investment relationship for decades. The Karakoram Highway was built from, the 50s through the late 70s through Chinese investment. So the China-Pakistan economic corridor is, let's call it, just the kind of latest iteration of that type of relationship. But India's been long concerned about growing Chinese presence and influence across the entire Indian Ocean region.
And what's India's response been to that growing influence?
It's been severalfold. First of all, India has looked to identify what it could do in response to some of the Belt and Road investment issues. It is a collaborating partner with the government of Japan on trying to develop something that they are calling the Africa-Asia Growth Corridor, which would develop links across the east coast of Africa all the way in across into Southeast Asia. So that's one example. India has sought to improve its ties with all of its neighbors. The most successful case has been with Bangladesh, where In 2014 and 2015, India and Bangladesh were able to overcome what had been a 70-plus year dispute of their border, the world's craziest border. It was a border that had, I don't know if anybody's seen this map, but the border between India and Bangladesh actually included what used to be called enclaves, where you had islands of extraterritoriality on either side, so just a very difficult border to administer. They have actually regularized this. They've exchanged territory. They have figured out a way to resolve this. They have a much improved relationship. India had a very difficult relationship with Sri Lanka during the Mahinda Rajapaksa presidency, in large part because of Indian concerns over the treatment of Sri Lanka's Tamil minority. India has a very large Tamil population in the state of Tamil Nadu and other parts of India. So it had been very vocal about problems with the then Sri Lankan government. With the change of government in January 2015, their relationship is vastly improved. India's relationship with Nepal, they sought to improve, but it actually now is not doing very well, in large part because India has been very vocal about what they saw as problems with Nepal's new constitution that the Indian government felt didn't adequately look after the interests of Nepali people who live along the border regions. So here's a case where a concern for human rights and a vocal concern for human rights ended up presenting challenges to their bilateral relationship.
These are mostly India's near abroad, the countries around India, but we also...
They're most concerned about that space and the Chinese influence. That's why I focused on those, but yeah.
But we also see now there's a satellite arrangement between India and Vietnam. We've seen Indian ships in the east of Singapore in the Indo-Pacific. Can we expect to see more Indian involvement east of Southeast Asia and in Southeast Asia and in the Pacific Ocean as well?
I think for now we can expect to see a continued deepening of the India-Vietnam relationship. It's a special relationship. India has oil and gas exploration investments with Vietnam. They've got a strong relationship there. The India-Singapore relationship, again, very strong. I think we can expect to see India looking to further its ties with Southeast Asian countries. They are stepping up what they are doing, looking to the east. India had a foreign policy from 1992 forward that was called Look East. In 2014, they changed that to Act East. So I think we can expect to see a little bit more activity. But Vietnam, as you mentioned, is a particularly special relationship there.
And we should certainly talk about the Quad and what that will actually turn out to be. What do Indian strategic thinkers see the Quad as giving them? What sort of advantages does it see as accruing to India as being for being part of the Quad?
Well, I think everybody's right now trying to figure out what the Quad is. So, I say that with there's a lot of misinterpretation about what the Quad is. The Quad has been essentially a meeting between the United States, Japan, India, and Australia. I have seen some very excited analyses from many different countries talking about the Quad as some new potential Asian NATO. It is very far from being that. I have seen people talking about the Quad as if it's some sort of full-blown multilateral organization with a very developed diplomatic calendar and program of agenda. I mean, it isn't any of those things yet. So far, it's just a meeting. And so what I think people are looking for, the United States included, I imagine the same is the case for Australia and for Japan, is a sense of what might be the next agenda items to develop for the next meeting. And the one after that, I mean, it really so far is a very inchoate kind of it's not even an organization, it is just a meeting. It's as if a trilateral meeting has added one more partner. So right now, it isn't anything other than a meeting of some diplomats at the assistant secretary level.
And we should probably say, I should have prefaced this by saying, of course, we're talking about a meeting between Japanese, Indian, American, and Australian diplomats.
Yes.
The last time there was a Quad in 2007, it was Australia that pulled out. Kevin Rudd, under Chinese pressure, pulled out of the Quad. And I understand there was some apprehension in India that Australia might do the same again, might bow to Chinese pressure regarding the Quad. Is that still a concern in Delhi, or is that something that has passed? Are they reassured about Australia's interest in joining these sorts of minilateral efforts now?
Well, there is certainly some question about how Australia's interest level, given what had happened before. Again, nobody has signed up for some sort of permanent new multilateral organization, so it isn't as if this is anything other than arranging a meeting. But if it does become a more institutionalized gathering, so let's say if the four countries in the Quad decide that they'll have an annual gathering on the margins of the UN General Assembly, or if it takes on more regularity by having, let's say, a sort of military exercise component, who knows what it will become, because it's not yet any of these things. It needs to have more elaboration of what it will become and what the four countries would like to see it become. But certainly there's interest among all four countries, India included, in being able to exchange views on the question of regional developments, how each country sees those, challenges that China is posing in the region. India has been very vocal about its concerns about the way the Belt and Road initiatives use non-transparent financing and can create some vulnerabilities in smaller countries that don't have the ability to pay these loans back that are at market rates, and with, again, nobody's quite sure what the actual financing package is. So those kinds of issues, I think, are on the agenda potentially for the future, but I anticipate seeing a process among all four countries of thinking about what they should talk about next, when they should meet next, and at what level.
You'd speak at some length in the book about Indian strategic thought and the efforts in recent years to try and map India's current diplomacy onto historical documents. And we often talk, when we talk about China, about Sun Tzu and the Art of War, but we don't often talk about these documents when we talk about India. But they're pretty important, aren't they, in terms of how Indians conceptualize what they're doing now?
It's been interesting to see. One of the reasons I wrote about this development is because, for me, what's been very interesting has been a real popular interest in Indian traditions, traditional texts, Indian strategic thinking, and applying that to contemporary life. You can walk into any bookstore, any English language bookstore in India, and there will be maybe 10 titles of books about Chanakya's 10 lessons of leadership, or management lessons to derive from Indian texts. To me, that's a way of saying, let's use our own traditions to think about ways that we interact with the world and we interact with the disciplines that have been taught from a Western perspective, but from which we can also draw upon our own traditions as well.
And what can we learn from looking at those traditions in terms of how Indians conceptualize their world? You talk a little bit about the concept of mandalas and how Indian strategic thinkers view their region. Is that still useful today in terms of thinking about South Asia?
I think it's useful. I don't think it's exclusive in the sense of, I think India's foreign policy strategists, its defense strategists, are drawing upon many different kinds of worlds in the way they think about what their next steps should be and how India should orient itself to this changing world. But I think the fact of trying to bring up and draw upon India's own traditions is in a way part of the process of saying, you know, our traditions matter too. I think I cite one author who's written a lot about Indian myths for a public audience, a writer named Devdutt Patnaik. And he talks a lot about how the disciplines of the West have always looked at the East in Western terms. And this is really more of an effort to use one's own terms in the East for one's own purposes. But it doesn't mean that people have kind of jettisoned the idea of thinking about realism as a concept. But for example, you might argue that the mandala theory is actually very realist when you think about it, that the neighbor of your neighbor could be your friend if your neighbor is your enemy. I mean, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we think of that as coming from Arab culture, but actually it comes from the Arthashastra, right? Yeah, it's an Indian concept.
Yeah.
Can we speak a little bit about the economy? You talk about some of the efforts in recent years to liberalize India's economy. And
Indonesia too.
Yeah, in Indonesia perhaps less quickly even.
Yeah.
But you know, can you speak a little bit about those efforts and where you see them going in the coming years? Do Indians feel as though they've made great strides in terms of liberalizing their economy?
You know, a lot of my book spends time on the question of India's economic liberalization and going back to the importance of 1991 as a moment of opening and what that has meant. You know, the first decades of Indian independence, people believed that socialist planning was actually going to help India overcome its vulnerabilities and build a strong economy that could allow it to stand with the strongest in the world. I mean, you can read Nehru's letters to all of his chief ministers, and this is what they were trying to do. It didn't work out that way, as we know. So this 1991 moment, which occurred under a time of duress where India had basically the end of its foreign exchange and had to go through a quite significant IMF, International Monetary Fund, reform package and borrow against its gold reserves in order to just stay afloat. This began a process that continues to this day and remains incomplete. So there's two ways to look at this question of economic reform in India. And I think if you were to ask most people in India, they would say, we've done so much. We have opened up so tremendously since 1991. You can look at how open our economy is now. We are a trading nation. 40% of GDP is, you know, trade derived. There's another way of looking at this issue, and that is that India is not as open as many other economies, particularly across Asia, where you see countries that are extremely open and very integrated with each other in trade and supply chain links. And India is not yet there. And so certainly in U.S.-India conversations about trade and economics, those are often pretty tense discussions because the American side would like to see a much more open Indian economy, a place where you can have greater levels of foreign direct investment, where trade isn't so difficult. In fact, the U.S. President, President Trump, has been seized with the issue of Harley-Davidsons for, I don't know, the last couple weeks, which this is front page news in India. It may not have made the front pages here, but it is front page news in India. People think they've reformed a lot, and so if they've brought down tariffs from what used to be 100% to 75%, that sounds like a big concession. But comparatively, compared to what those barriers may be in a place like Thailand, it doesn't look so good. And so that's the rub when you're always in a negotiation or some kind of a conversation with India about economic reform issues. It always comes back to this. The U.S. would like to see much more faster. Indian economic leaders feel like, well, we've done so much already. We need time.
You're right that one of the big mistakes that Western analysts make when they look at Indian domestic politics is to map our own left-right divides, in which the left, at least superficially, advocates a more interventionist role in the economy, and the right advocates a more free market economy, to map those divides onto India. Why is that a mistake?
Well, because the left and the right come together full circle and end up having the same belief in statism and protected economies. So you've got Marxists and communists who believe that the Indian economy should be state planned. And on the other end of the political spectrum, you have very conservative Hindu nationalists who have organizations that believe in Swadeshi production, that the Indian economy should be produced in India by Indians for Indians, and foreign goods and foreign capital should be kept out. Now, that's an extreme position. You can find that position. It is an extreme position, but that position is almost exactly like the state planning position. So I do think that you really can't try to map the same sort of right-left. There's no sort of small government position in the way that in the United States you'd have a more left progressive view of a positive role that the government can play in a country, society, and economy, and a left or a right small government view. There's not yet a small government view really in India.
And yet in both parties we've seen economic reformers emerge. Manmohan Singh in 1991 in the early 90s was one of the key reformers within Congress. Now we have Narendra Modi, who's seen as being a liberalizing reformer within the BJP. Do you see that continuing? Do you see reformers continuing to have an opportunity to lead both parties, or do you see one party becoming more associated with economic reform and one coalition becoming less associated with it?
I think the Congress Party and Manmohan Singh as finance minister will always be seen as the party that opened India to the world, that began India's economic reforms. In the two governments that the Congress Party led, the UPA, the United Progressive Alliance governments from 2004 to 2014, were not able to advance reforms in the same way that they had been able to do so, again, under duress in the early 90s. In large part, I attribute it to the fact that they didn't have a single-party majority in government. So they had two governments that were supported by socialist and communist parties. Some of these parties left support of the government over specific reform issues. And so they had to go slow and try to build consensus over economic reform issues. And sometimes you can't go slow enough on those questions to satisfy multiple coalition partners. And to me, that was the challenge and really the problem of the reform story for the previous Congress-led governments. Now, the BJP government now in power, came into power, there was a lot of expectation that they would do more to advance tremendous economic reform. They had done a lot more than the previous Congress-led governments did, but I think many people are disappointed that they haven't been able to do yet more. They haven't privatized any state-owned enterprises, although you do see in the papers reports that Air India has been approved for some sort of divestment. I've been reading about Air India being approved for some sort of divestment for a long time now, so we'll see how that advances. But some of the more difficult economic reform challenges have been too high a hurdle for the BJP government to clear, including on revising labor laws and on land acquisition laws. That's proven too tough. They did manage to get a constitutional amendment passed to create a national goods and services tax. This is a very big deal. A constitutional amendment is no cakewalk in anybody's parliament, let alone getting it ratified by half your states. So that's a very big deal. That was implemented last year with some degree of difficulty. It's kind of widely believed that the challenge of implementing a very complicated goods and services tax ended up leading to a drop in India's economic growth rate for last year. Although I don't know if anybody saw the news today, actually late last night, that the Indian economy is back up to 7.2% growth, which will make it now the world's fastest growing large economy.
A lot of economies would be happy to have 7% growth right
now.
Yeah. But you know, I'm curious as to how history informs some of these policy responses, because you speak in the book and you quote Shashi Tharoor talking about how India, before British colonialism, was 23% of world trade, or accounted for 23% of world trade. How do historical memories of the British rule of the Raj affect policy responses? Is that an overstated influence on policy responses in India, or is that still something that has had a lasting impact?
My analysis is that the sense of colonization and the economic effects, the economic role that colonization played, is always there somehow below the surface. One of the examples I cite was the effort that Facebook tried a few years ago to implement access to internet, sort of free access that they called free basics. This became a complicated debate about whether it was really internet access or if it was only going to allow people access to Facebook-approved apps and this sort of thing. But in any case, you know, people were talking about this as the East India Company all over again. You know, the fact that that was even an available, quote, an available way to talk about internet access provided by this company, Facebook, just struck me as it's always right there. You see reform in India moving incrementally, step by step. There will be sectors that are totally closed, sectors of the economy that are gradually opened to foreign investment. Insurance is a case that's easy to talk about. It was opened in 1999 to 26% foreign investment. People have spent the last 10 plus years trying to get that investment cap moved further. So it was recently opened further to 49%. And when that happened, there was also a rider put into the regulation that requires that board control must remain in Indian hands. I mean, you don't see this in a lot of other countries where you can have a foreign-owned company with full foreign investment, and it's not seen as a huge difficulty to go through some sort of process to gradually increase the level of investment. You see this very frequently in India.
That's really interesting. I guess one of the things that I really like about your book is that you take us almost in a journalistic way into the offices and homes of some of the leading public intellectuals, businessmen, politicians, diplomats in India. And one of the senses you get is this sense of rising self-confidence. The idea that Indians really know where their place in the world should be and they're prepared to take it. But for a country that has this rising self-confidence, Indians tend to be still very sensitive to foreign criticism. You talk about some of the examples in your book, in particular a BBC documentary that was aired in 2015, and which was banned in India and became the subject of debate in the national parliament. But what's behind that sensitivity to criticism from foreigners?
I broadly think there's a sense that people don't give India a fair shake, and that it is constantly being talked about only in terms of its problems. And India has many problems. I think there's no question these problems are all very well known. You can pick up any newspaper anywhere in India or abroad and read about them. So India has lifted more than 160 million people out of poverty, out of extreme poverty, in the years from 2004 to late 2012. It still is the country with the world's largest total number of people living in extreme poverty. So you can look at this in a couple ways. You can look at it as a place that has brought tremendous numbers of people out of poverty, but it still has far to go. India has done a lot to empower people from diverse backgrounds, but it still has problems of social discrimination that remain. These are still challenges. There are still problems with bias and violence against women. There are problems of religious discrimination. There are problems of caste discrimination. What I think people feel is that oftentimes they are seen only in terms of the problems, and that it has been difficult for the outside world to see past those many problems and see India for the totality that it is. So that's why you see successive Indian leaders focused on this idea of India attaining for itself its due place. Manmohan Singh used to talk about India receiving its due place in global councils, gaining that recognition on the world stage as a major global power, even despite its many problems, which the country is working on, has not managed to overcome all of them. I think none of us in any of our countries have, but India does have some particularly large hurdles. Even as it has all these challenges at home, I think people feel that, you know, why aren't we recognized for what we have managed to accomplish? We've maintained this democracy against the odds for more than 70 years, major contributor to global peacekeeping, one of the world's largest militaries, third largest in personnel strength, fifth or sixth largest in terms of defense budget, depending on how you count. So, you know, there's a lot happening there for India, even though it still does have all these domestic challenges and vulnerabilities. So that's my long answer to this, because I get this question a lot. That's my long answer to the question that, you know, people want to be seen in their totality of the accomplishments and not just the vulnerabilities and weaknesses.
Let's open it up to questions. I think we'll have quite a few. I might just start right here in the front row.
Hi, I'm Jackie Range. I'm a journalist. Has demonetization had any impact on corruption?
Well, that's a hard one to answer. So the purpose of demonetization was to have a huge impact on corruption. It's not clear to me what that effect has been. I think in the short term, it had a very damaging effect on the informal economy, which was being run on a cash basis. Analysts, let's say from Moody's, have looked at the demonetization issue as something that over the long term will bring benefits to the Indian economy through digitizing financial transactions. I think the jury is really out on the actual effect that it has had on corruption.
Chris Skinner, would you please comment on Australia, on India's role in worldwide innovation? And I'm thinking particularly of the diaspora of Indian academics throughout the world, especially in the USA.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think increasingly India is very focused on innovation as an economic driver, something that is important for scientific development that can then percolate out throughout the economy. You see Indian Americans, and I'm sure there are a lot of Indian Australians in the business space in science and technology here. There's a very large presence of Indian Americans in our technology firms in Silicon Valley. This is a well-known fact. There are strong links between startups in the United States and smaller startups or offices in India. So that's a very positive story to tell. The Indian government is actually looking to try to increase the role of innovation in society. They have a Startup India initiative that makes it easier to gain access to funding for new startups. And they have a whole focus on innovation, not only in what we typically think of as innovation in kind of new high technology space, but also innovation at what people call the bottom of the pyramid. So innovation in service delivery to bring different kinds of goods to the poorest of the poor. So innovation in that sense as well.
Want to follow up on that? How does this BJP government in particular see the Indian diaspora in political terms? Because we see the Prime Minister going around the world holding rallies with large numbers of Indian diaspora. It's not something that we see a lot of national leaders do, but there's a large Indian diaspora in a lot of places. Does the Indian government see the Indian diaspora as also a tool through which it can accomplish some of its policy goals?
100% yes. For the BJP government, the Indian diaspora has been a crucial component of India's soft power around the world. Actually, the previous BJP-led government in India, the Vajpayee government, created something back in 1998 or 1999, it was around then, called Resurgent India Bonds. And the idea was to provide a vehicle, a financial vehicle, through which diaspora members could invest in India's growth and development. So they saw the diaspora as able to bring kind of financial support to India's economic development. What the Modi government is doing is a kind of more visible aspect of this, expanding the size and scale of the outreach to the Indian diaspora, engaging with the Indian diaspora as leaders in business around the world. You can also see in the intervening years between 98 and today, certainly in the United States, we've got, you know, a number of different companies that are led by Indian Americans, so very high profile. So that's been a real asset for the Indian government. It's a big piece of how the BJP sees the kind of the spread of India and India's soft power around the world.
Indian Link Media Group. Now, during the last election, the BJP decimated the Congress party and effectively has had no great opposition in the last few years. How do you see the Congress party regrouping for the next election and beyond?
So, everybody knows not to make predictions about what's going to happen in India's national elections because almost everybody was wrong about what happened in 2014. And my focus is India on the world stage. This is a book about India on the world stage, not about India's domestic politics. I look at India's domestic politics as they affect the way India interacts with the world on trade, on diplomacy, on its security. It's hard to say what's going to happen when they do call the election. Will they do it before the end of this calendar year or wait until, you know, May, April 2019? We'll have to see. We do see a little bit more energy now in the Congress party. There has been a lot of talk about the Gujarat state election and the more positive showing of the Congress party there and the fact that the BJP did not gain more seats but actually lost a few. It still won, but they didn't have the showing they'd like to have. It's also true that people are now talking about big gains in the Northeast. So, you know, everything is always kind of based on the last state-level election as a way of seeing which way the weather vane is pointing. So I'd be a fool to give you a prediction now.
Zafar Khan, do you see any economic impetus assisting the relationship between India and Pakistan moving forward?
Do I see any economic impetus? I wish I could say that I did. Look, from my perspective, some of the most positive momentum between India and Pakistan was in the 2011-2012 period when it looked as if they were going to move on several things. Deeper cross-border engagement on electricity, cross Punjab electricity, cross Punjab LNG piping, that never came to fruition. It looked in Pakistan as if Pakistan was finally ready to offer India the mutual recognition that nobody in Pakistan wants to call most favored nation status. They call it non-discriminatory market access. You're nodding. Yeah. So you've heard this one many times before. That looked like it was very close. That would really potentially open up trade between these two countries that I mean, they are not close to what their trade potential could be. Made it through the National Assembly and then kind of disappeared, supposedly disapproved by the military. So it's hard for me to see further economic engagement between India and Pakistan if these kinds of initiatives can't make it past the kind of military authorities in Pakistan. I think the civilians want to see deeper engagement. I think the desire is there and the benefits could be there, not just for India and Pakistan, but to open up the entire South Asia region as a region of greater commerce and broader connectivity. I wish I could have a more optimistic answer. If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would have been more optimistic.
You mentioned very early on in the book that that Pakistan and its rivalry with India will continue to remain a break on what India can accomplish on the world stage. Not many great powers have a rival so close and so powerful. And of course, the nuclear rivalry plays into this as well. But are there specific ways in which the Pakistan-India rivalry exercises a break on its ability to exercise leadership throughout the world?
So I do talk about this as a drag on India's ability to do more, but I don't think that it's an existential problem. And I think for many years, people viewed the South Asia region and viewed India's potential as fundamentally limited by its difficult relationship with Pakistan. I do think that they're going to continue to have a really bad relationship. This is, you know, two nuclear powers next to each other. They don't have a strong channel of communication. They do have a National Security Advisors channel that meets from time to time, but you know, they really could be having a more open conversation. But, you know, India has said, we're ready to talk, but the terrorism has to stop. And there are big problems in Pakistan with dealing with terrorist groups that are active, actively operating from Pakistani territory and that are launching terrorist attacks in India. And you've seen the latest conversation globally about the Financial Action Task Force. Pakistan is on the docket to be placed on the blacklist of the FATF group starting in June. Again, it's, you know, this challenge where all countries that are participating in the Financial Action Task Force have said, Pakistan, you've got to deal with this problem. So I think that having to pay attention to the challenge of terrorism, having to maintain a level of military readiness, having the inability to look to the broader South Asian region as a region of economic connectivity and commercial exchange, the way the entirety of Southeast Asia and East Asia is, those are all breaks on India. Those are drags on India. But I don't think that it stops the country from having larger global ambitions.
In the back, Richard McGregor, on his first day as a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute.
I think it's fair to say that India has always or has viewed China with a deal of anxiety. But if you look, unless I'm wrong, companies like Alibaba and Tencent are doing quite well in India now in you know, payment systems, some of the mobile phone companies as well. This is the sort of development that, if it were to happen in Australia now, would probably have a little bit of pushback. So does the Indian government look at that with equanimity, the advance of the Alibabas and Tencents inside India?
This has all happened just in the last couple of years in the payment space. The Indian government has been very concerned about Chinese communications technology, particularly things like routers, hardware that can be a, you know, integral piece of communications infrastructure. So there's been issues going back years with requiring certain kinds of inspections and certifications for the import of routers and other kinds of communications hardware. Absolutely. I don't know if there will be a new sense of concern about the levels of investment in the payments technology. It's possible we might see that. The concern about hardware, I felt like, just sort of emerged overnight, maybe in 2011, 2012, around that period. And that remains the case to this day.
You and Graham?
Can you say a little bit more about the India-Japan relationship? We talk about load-bearing relationships. Maybe among the intra-Asian relationships, it might be the most important of all in terms of pushback against China. To what extent is it framed that way from an Indian perspective? Does India see it purely through a sort of geostrategic, geoeconomic lens? I know that Modi is particularly invested in the personal relationship with Abe, and that Tokyo was his first destination, I think, as Prime Minister, which always tells you something.
First out of region. The first destination was Bhutan.
Oh, okay. What do you see its potential going forward?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. This is a very important relationship. And I think sometimes Americans don't appreciate how important this relationship is for India. Actually, Japan has been a major investor in India. India's automobile success story is due to the involvement of Suzuki in helping India become one of the world's largest producers of small cars. That goes back to the mid-80s. Japan, very different than the United States, and I'm not sure how Australia's aid and development works, but certainly what Japan has brought to the relationship with India has been a level of development assistance, technological support, financing packages that has been very, very helpful to India. The relationship between Japan and India, so going in 2006, Abe went to India, and Japan and India signed something called a strategic and global partnership. And then in 2014, they elevated that to a special strategic and global partnership. And to my knowledge, that is the only special strategic and global partnership that India has. It has a number of strategic partnerships, including with the United States. But this relationship with Japan is something that is quite special. So not only is Japan involved with India for India's own economic development support, they are partners in the quest to have a more equitable UN Security Council set of permanent seats. India, Japan, Brazil, and Germany are all together a group of four seeking that permanent membership in a reformed Security Council. Japan is very actively working with India to try to identify solutions, as you mentioned, a pushback to the China Belt and Road Initiative. The Africa-Asia Growth Corridor is just one. They have other areas where they're looking at cooperation on financing, including in the Northeast and around into Southeast Asia. So that's a very positive relationship for India, very important, and somewhat different from India's relationship with the United States because it doesn't have that veneer of worrying about partnering with a superpower that is so overtly a military power around the world.
Francis Kitt.
I just wanted to ask a follow-up question on this Asia-Africa Economic Growth Corridor. And if you could elaborate on the importance of it, how is it spoken about in India, and is it always seen as a sort of strategic competitor to the Belt and Road Initiative, or does it have other components that will be, you know, economically useful for India as well? So if you could add a little bit more, that'd be really useful. Thanks.
I think people are still trying to identify exactly what this will be, what the components will be, what role India can play to develop this, how it will fit in with larger conversations about infrastructure financing around the region and globally. You know, there are aspects of India's interest in deepening its connectivity to its immediate east, including through Bangladesh and better connecting Bangladesh with Myanmar, Burma, and down into Southeast Asia. That would benefit India directly because it would create better linkages for shipments. But I do think that certainly this is a concept that is still unfolding in the descriptions of what it will actually deliver and what it is intended to accomplish.
Thank you. Very stimulating conversation. My name is Darshak Mehta. The question I have is, you've served as a very senior Obama administration official. Now, is there the same sort of continuity of policy with your successors? And also, do you think that in the next 5 years, India will be a permanent member of the UN?
Those are pretty different questions. Two of them. Okay. Let me take the first one. So far, there has been broad bipartisan continuity in the United States on the relationship with India. You've seen a commitment to deepening the relationship move ahead from the opening under the Clinton administration to the George W. Bush administration and the civil nuclear deal, and really developing a much more strategic defense relationship with India. The Obama administration really plussed up the defense component of the relationship with India. That is now one of the most successful aspects of U.S.-India relations. The Trump administration seems to be continuing that path. They are continuing to work harder on developing deeper defense ties with India. It's not easy. This is going to take a long time. but developing possible platforms to collaborate on and eventually perhaps co-develop, finding ways to partner with India more deeply in Afghanistan. You saw President Trump call for more extensive Indian economic engagement in Afghanistan. You have also seen the Trump administration be very vocal about their concerns with Pakistan, which I believe is a continuation of where the Obama administration ended up in the last year of the Obama administration. So in the U.S., India is a nearly unique foreign policy question in that there's kind of broad bipartisan consensus on the trajectory. It's hard to find bipartisan consensus in the United States on nearly anything, but India is among them. You see kind of the same thing in India as well, where we've had continued strengthening of ties across BJP, then Congress, and now BJP-led governments. So it seems to be, for the time being at least, we can safely anticipate continued trajectory of strengthening ties. The next part of your question was about India's membership in the Security Council. I have made the case, and I make this case in the book, knowing that this is probably the most difficult institution of global governance in which to seek reform. A lot of people have been seeking reform of the UN Security Council, and it hasn't advanced one inch. President Obama voiced support for Indian membership in a reformed and expanded UN Security Council back in 2010. What's happened so far? Nothing. So, you know, the Indian government has been trying to advance what they called text-based reform by introducing a resolution a year and a half ago. We can see the outcome. So far, nothing. So the UN is a very, very difficult space to see reform. I would guess that in 5 years, money would be on seeing almost no progress. But it doesn't mean that we should not talk about how important this is. It's an important issue for global equity. If you were going to design a UN Security Council today, it wouldn't have the composition of the five members it has, most likely. I think you'd see a lot of pushback even from within Europe on that question. So we ought to be able to continue talking about this even while recognizing the severe hurdles just institutionally to getting any reform to move.
Question in the back from Chris Brazin.
Thank you. As an occasional visitor to India, I wonder if you'd let us in a little bit more into your relationship with the place and how that came to be and how the place actually affects you, because I think it's very hard to spend any time in India without coming away rather different in the way that you view the world.
Well, I opened my book with my first trip to India on a college semester abroad program in the fall of 1990. So it tells you how old I am, one. And two, it tells you that my first experience in India as a student was in a place that was incredibly chaotic politically. There were regular daily protests that fall over the issue of implementing affirmative action policies to provide places for subordinate caste groups in higher education and certain kinds of government jobs. This met with huge pushback at the time. It actually brought down the Indian government at that time. Students were self-immolating on the streets. This was before India's economic opening in 1991. So I provide one anecdote where my husband told me I have to put this in the book, and I did. I wasn't sure about doing it. But you know, prior to my going on this college semester abroad program, I had an academic advisor who said, you know, you ought to bring some plastic placemats for people as gifts. They'll really like that. I mean, I can't imagine bringing plastic placemats as gifts for people today because there isn't an economy of want and deprivation today across all of India in the way that there was at that time. So India has changed a lot. I had the opportunity to have my eyes opened to the way such a large number of people in our world live, and to be able to learn. I'm still learning, to be honest. This is a huge country. You can always learn something new. There are so many different cultures and languages. You can almost never exhaust the kind of, oh, I didn't know that. Wow, I've got to read some more. Aspect to India. So, of course, it's affected me. I've ended up spending my entire professional career focused on South Asia. As I also say in the book, my parents thought I would never get a job. So I'm glad that things have worked out okay on that front.
For yeah. You as well as for India, then. Yeah,
exactly.
Paul Manaharan.
I'm My name is Paul Manoharan. I went to school in the U.S. and studied under Professor Peter Rao, specialized on U.S. foreign policy towards India, wrote my short thesis on Reagan administration.
Oh, wow.
Quite interesting. The question that I have for you is, while I was a student in India way back in the 90s, I met a professor by name Roger Hilsman. Roger Hilsman taught at Columbia. He was retired by then. He was out at my university delivering a lecture on the importance of the relationship between India and U.S., and more so to do with the regional security and prosperity. Largely from what you said or shared today, nothing much has changed. We're still talking about those issues that still underpin. So those are the fault lines that exist. Where do you see this, you know, besides the economic impetus and growth and all of that stuff, so the broader themes continue to stay there, you know, and you're still sort of, you know, talking about those issues maybe in different ways. Where do you think, are we making a, you know, India or perhaps the other actors in that part of the world, or maybe the global actors, are working, you know, in a concerted way to address those issues first and then talk about the next phase?
I'm just not sure which issues you mean. If you talk about the U.S.-India relationship, I actually feel that it's been dramatically transformed.
It has certainly warmed up now. It's certainly, you know, there's been a huge progress.
Yeah.
But when you look at regional security issues, and you spoke about India's influence, and rising influence, a lot of the agenda is driving around, you know, India's positioning. But at the same time, there's lack of recognition, going back to that other gentleman's question on the seat in the U.N. Security Council, mm-hmm. which has been debated for how many, you know, years. And so, you know, to me, those are symptoms of, you know, those need to be fixed first, and then, you know, that may eventuate into, you know, positive outcomes for India as well as.
I think India's ability increasingly to deliver regionally as, again, I'll use the term a net provider of regional security, is fundamentally different now than it was 15 years ago. The India-U.S. defense relationship is much deeper. We had a zero defense relationship 15 years ago. Now India exercises more with the United States than with any other country. The United States exercises more with India than any other non-NATO, than any other NATO partner. It's the number one non-NATO partner that the United States exercises with. This is a big deal. India increasingly has military platforms that are interoperable with the United States. Our ability to do things together and help in times of crisis and help think about security in the Indian Ocean region is directly related to these developments. I think it's actually a huge change. Now, what isn't a change is the problems with Pakistan. What isn't a change, although it is a change in terms of its quantum leap, is the influence of China in the region. Maybe 15 years ago, we would have seen its deep relationship with Pakistan as a big issue and concern, and its developing relations with Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Maldives, Nepal. Now those are, let's say, amped up in much more significant concerns. So there are elements that definitely remain the case and remain areas for continued work. But I do think, particularly on the defense side, that's just so different than it was before. So I would say that aspect of where India is, what it is doing, what it seeks to become, and the role that it will play, that has changed.
Thanks, Alyssa, for coming by the Institute. The book is Our Time Has Come, and Alyssa has graciously offered to stick around and to sign a few copies, which are available over here in the corner. But thank you so much for coming by the Institute, and safe travels back to D.C.
Thank you. Very happy. Thanks to all of you for coming today.